welcome to the Canon Cantina, a Star Wars podcast about everything canon, legends, and so much more. We're back. It's a really exciting time because we have the new season of The Mandalorian. That's, of course, season two. Though the numbers of the episodes just continue like normal, which I really do like. I have an excellent guest this week in Alden from Octo Radio. Alden, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, man. I am so excited to finally be in a period. I mean, we had this with Squadrons, you know, and the story and everything, but to be in a period now where narrative Star Wars is happening and we're not in a holding pattern of waiting and quarantine is so nice.
You're absolutely right, because that's you and I's MO, and of course Mike's as well. And yeah, just Star Wars narrative. It's been scarce for some time. Basically, even the books being pushed back too, right, is just a whole nother thing that was really upsetting here on the Canon Cantina. And of course, you know, going forward, but it seems like things are getting back on track. And what a better thing to do it than, of course, the Squadron's narrative story, which Alden and I went into our initial thoughts on my other show, Project Starhawk, about our thoughts on the narrative of the campaign without spoilers. So if you want to listen to that, definitely check that out on Project Starhawk. But now we're fully into the narrative of, personally, just like my favorite thing in Star Wars these days, which of course is The Mandalorian. And man, what a way to get narrative too, right, Alden?
Yeah, I mean, this steady drip, I mean, I remember back when season one was coming out and we found out the information that it would be week to week. I was unsure about it, but it has been such a killer choice. I love week to week.
I am very passionate about week to week. This is something I've spouted on, I think, every podcast I've done since the beginning of time. I understand the fun of binging, and we've all done it, you know, things like Stranger Things dropping on the 4th of July. What an excellent decision they made to do that. Mm-hmm. But it's like this format, what I call the HBO format, or just the format of everything prior to the last decade, this format of releasing weekly is my personal favorite way to enjoy the meatier shows with more to digest, like the Game of Thrones, like the Mandalorian. And I think it's just so much more exciting. Like, you watch it with maybe hopefully friends and family. You enjoy it. You share an experience together, because you can't really do that so much with the Netflix format as much. It requires more planning for sure. And then you think about it for a week and rewatch it, and then you're ready for the next week by the time it comes around, and the anticipation is palpable.
Yeah. And what's interesting about that, you know, you talked about the planning and everything, and something that you can't plan for are the quieter story beats, some of which we'll get into here. And the problem with a binge is that you get to that moment with fan culture where the season ends, like Stranger Things season 3, for example, and people say, "Correct. Oh, that was such a great season." And then if you ask them, "Oh, what happened with, you know, with Steve this season?" They're like, "Well, I mean, it kind of blended together. I can't really remember." They remember the overall experience, but this format allows us to really get like days in with these new supporting characters, with these moments to really think about, wow, this is what this director did. And it affords the ability to have Star Wars fan conversations in the same way that you sort of get cinematically with, you know, the time after release is so important.
No, absolutely. And I think you couldn't have said it better. The enjoyment of the directors and creators that worked on these episodes is obviously much more amplified because nothing's blending together, because you're solely focusing on what, however many minutes the episode was and the creators that did it. And I think that's a huge asset as well. And I obviously think replayability is strong too, because maybe not everybody rewatches the episodes again like you and I do, Alden, but even if they sit and wait till the next week, I do believe the emotional impact of the characters, the stories, and especially these quiet moments, or even just a cool visual effect, is a lot more resonant with waiting weeks between time. And this kind of leads into my feeling on something I'm excited about, my other podcast, Fury's Finest. We're going to be doing reviews on WandaVision, and I'm so happy that show's in the same format. I really like what Disney Plus is doing with these more cinematic shows, where they're choosing to not release them in a binge format. I think it's really beneficial to digest.
I agree. It's an incredibly smart decision, especially to be counter-programming, and even just on the business end, you know, which we will see with WandaVision and the other shows that come down, you know, the pipeline, like Cassian Andor, like a Kenobi, like Falcon Winter Soldier, all of it, is that they get to control the media for an 8-week period instead of a 72-hour period. And that is so valuable now to establishing a legacy where Mandalorian is able to become mainstream. And my mom knows who the child is. And now legions of fans are finding out about other major supporting characters, you know, that were previously pretty niche. And it's because of the fact that the media goes for an entire week down this rabbit hole.
Yeah, that's a great example. You said controlling the media, obviously controlling the minds of the entertainment industry, and of course, social media too. And that's valuable. You're right, because maybe the non-diehard Star Wars fans might not be necessarily caught up on The Mandalorian right now. They might have just heard about it this week that it's back, and now they're kind of getting caught back up on this new season because it's been conversation for almost a month now. I think that's actually really valuable too, because as you said, it's kind of out there in the world, you know, doing segments on Good Morning America with characters from the show and things like that. Like, these things sometimes they spread in different ways, and I think it's all the better because you get more fans, get more people enjoying this show that we love so much and we want to spread to more people. And, you know, it's really digging into our love of Star Wars in a really unique way that the films haven't even been able to do because of their time frame and because of the release schedule. And what a cool way to spread our nitty-gritty love of Star Wars and Star Wars canon to the rest of the world.
Absolutely, man. I'm so excited to dive into this stuff. And again, like you were saying about spreading it to the rest of the world, this is such a unique experience and a unique cross-section of fans, a unique cross-section of approaches. It's just a really, really special time. And it's weird now to be in the second season because that whole, this has never been done before, live action Star Wars, like on television. And now it has been. And so the question was like, well, now how do you raise the bar? And I think we're going to find that we think it's definitely been raised.
The bar has been raised. And of course, I feel like we're being spoiled because, as you said, live action Star Wars television is now a thing that's part of our world going forward. And of course, that's going to even become more of a staple because we're about to start having live action Marvel television shows. That's going to be a different direction Marvel can go. This could probably be a little bit more interesting, deeper, more daring at times, hopefully, because they can take these risks like The Mandalorian's taken. They kind of laid the path. And of course, anyone that listens to the show is no stranger to my obsession with the character of Obi-Wan Kenobi and, you know, some strange likeness I have to this character and how excited I am for that show, because I think everything Mandalorian set up to this point, and even more so now with season two, I think Kenobi can really make some leaps and bounds on a dramatic level that they're going to feel confident about.
Absolutely. And again, confidence is key, what you're talking about, of what have we proven we can do now? What has the studio proven they could do on the technical level, but also in terms of, you know, I go back to the pilot of this show, the Dave Filoni's chapter one, The Mandalorian. And one of the first comments I saw was, whoa, it's weird to have Star Wars with TV pacing. Saw that a lot, not even in a bad way, but just in a, man, this opening scene's taken a while and things like that.
Yes.
And, you know, that threw people for a loop. And it has now, I think, emboldened, you know, someone like Deborah Chow, where, you know, you bring up Kenobi. Because of this show, I might get my 6-hour tone poem of walking in the desert that I wanted, you know?
It's what we all want. Yeah, it's very good. Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious too, because, I mean, as you said, Alden, yeah, the pacing and the moments in this show is so much more nuanced because they have time to breathe. And, you know, Mando is not a very verbal character, and this is a Western show at its heart and a samurai show at its heart. There's not even that much dialogue sometimes, and it works so well, not only with us, the diehard fans, but general audiences. So it's really opening up all these avenues in this nerd culture that we love so much, in Marvel, in Star Wars, things like Kenobi, things like Loki in the future. They can actually maybe make some risks that would be a little bit more attention grabbing maybe in the films. But on the shows, it can be a little bit more artistic, nuanced, maybe even, you know, something you might not catch until the second viewing. They might choose to do things like that because they have the room to do it. And audiences have proven they want it. There's a fervor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, like you said, the difference between the television experience / streaming experience and cinema is working to the benefit of this show. And a lot of people were like, oh, it's going to be the 8-hour movie. And I think that especially what this season has proven so far is that it is way more of a cousin to Clone Wars Rebels Resistance than it is to the Skywalker saga, much to its benefit in terms of the things that it's able to do. And I think that we will see a new family form with Falcon Winter Soldier, WandaVision, Loki. I don't think that those are going to play the same way, nor should they. And I think that that's really exciting business-wise and creatively for Disney+.
Absolutely. And we're going to get to know these characters and all these programs on a different level that we would have never, of course, gotten in any cinematic format, no matter how many films there are, because sometimes these quiet moments, like you mentioned, Alden, at the front of this, are truly defining and, you know, resonant moments with the audience, with these characters. And I think those quiet moments really sing here. And that just leads us right into The Mandalorian season 2. So Alden and I are going to talk about episodes 1 and 2 and get caught up. And then next episode, we will talk about episode 3, the latest episode. So Alden, let's just get right into episode 1. You already mentioned episode 1 of season 1, the Dave Filoni pilot. Episode 1 of this season, very different.
Very, very different. Very, you know, whereas that first chapter, and again, I also do want to note that I love that it's a continuing chapter numbering.
Absolutely.
I think that that's really important, very intentional. So many choices here, full of intent and full of, you know, setting the table for what the show is.
It almost seems like the seasons are just a way to signal to us what it is, but it has no bearing on the show whatsoever. It's almost more like a extended miniseries, maybe when it's fully done. We're going to look at this as just maybe the longest miniseries ever, which I know is a conundrum of sorts, but I know we have a tone shift. I know it's treating it like we know the characters in season 2, but like you said, if you watch this in the chronological order, I feel like it is going to feel like chapters building.
I agree. And again, you know, in comic books, there's that phrase of there's miniseries, but there's also maxi series. You know, this could be the first maxi series in TV history in terms of the way that they're building it. And you look at chapter 1 versus chapter 9, and you know, each of them doing their job to set the table for the season. One is so intimate, and it gets as big as, you know, Din Djarin and IG shooting up the people that are, you know, at the warehouse where the child is. But this one is just immensely enthralling. It's large. It's bombastic. It has reveals. It has, you know, the much talked about aspect ratio change. All the budget is on screen. This one I felt like was a really big statement in terms of the creator saying what we can do.
I think you're absolutely right. And it's so interesting because it truly has built off of not only what they did season 1 story-wise and kind of story beats-wise, but also, of course, budget, scale, and story they want to tell. And though it is just the next chapter, it is the beginning of a new season for us as, you know, people that are enjoying this content that's being put out. But let's just jump into the episode. So we go back to Tatooine, which I know is something Mike was worried about. He did enjoy the episode. We will leave that there because I think sometimes Tatooine gets given a bad rap because it is the Star Wars planet. Mm-hmm. That's my defense of it. I think it's obviously one of the most iconic, if not the most iconic Star Wars planet in all of Star Wars. And, you know, there's a lot of ties to George Lucas's love of things like 2001 and, of course, Frank Herbert's Dune and all these sort of things. Why Tatooine's so important in the culture. But then, of course, to us as fans, the birthplace of the Skywalkers, you know, the hero's journey, so many things. It's so interesting to see the show, like The Mandalorian, go to it in season 1, go to it in season 2. And it's not under that hero's journey format. It's not a young Anakin, a young Luke, or even a Rey on Jakku sort of format. It's completely different. Like you said, intimate and small with the characters that we're given, because it's not something as grand as the Force and this sort of Empire versus Rebellion. Tatooine's just the scene. And what's cool about that is we get so much of Tatooine that we've been obsessed with for so long. Maybe just myself personally, I've always been so obsessed with the Tuskens, the Krayt Dragons, the farmers out in the middle of nowhere, the people past Mos Eisley. Mos Eisley, you remember, is the big city, the people at Anchorhead, the people that just live truly in small farming communities. We see all this in this episode, the best of legends, the best of canon, coalescing and bringing it to a generalized audience. And I think that's great.
Absolutely. I mean, what you just said right there, this coalescing, I mean, Knights of the Old Republic fans ate good, man. It was a fun time for us indeed with the Krayt Dragon stuff, but also building on Chapter 5. And Chapter 5 has been probably the most maligned chapter of the show so far.
Correct.
Star Wars does that amazing thing where retroactively we can make a thing better and we can elevate something. So now you watch Chapter 5 and, you know, you get that one scene of Din communicating in sign language with the Tuskens. And now with this information that we get in this scene about the way that he's able to work with them, the way that he's able to, you know, calm down their pets and eat their food and drink their water and embed himself in their society, that relationship is richer. The planet is richer. Knowing that Mos Pelgos is there makes Tatooine richer across all media. So it's a layering of what we've seen. And like you said, it's not a hero's journey. And I think that what Mandalorian does so well is say, all right, we had a couple heroes' journeys, three of them, that have all tied into Tatooine, and we've gotten the background stuff. And Mandalorian is all about, what if the background stuff was the A stuff that serves the story so well? where we see in both of these chapters, you know, we'll get to chapter 10 shortly, but it's all just, well, what if that thing from that piece of concept art was the main thing? What if that place was the main thing?
I'm so happy Doug Chang's part of the show. I know he's pushing some of that, which is good stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the man's a genius. But yeah, I think what you just said, Alden, about these background characters becoming the forefront and these stories from canon, from legends, from video games that are not the main stories by any means, becoming the forefront or even pulling from those what they like. There's been so many incredible stories in Legends just about Tatooine, like things as obscure as, you know, Galaxy of Fear, the Young Jedi Knights, of course, the Legends Kenobi novel, which is a favorite of mine. Like you said, Knights of the Little Republic, all these elements of just Tatooine that have become culture, they've distilled it down. Things have come back and things have moved forward. But what's so interesting about this is you have to look at this in the format of this is what the general audience is getting on the deep dives of Tatooine. We almost have to separate ourselves from all this prior knowledge that we have from the games, from the books, canon, legends, all of it about Tatooine and just examine, wait a second, all the general audience of Star Wars has is the theatrical films and these Mandalorian episodes, and that's really the bulk of Tatooine. And that's so cool because things like Banthas, Tuskens, all these things become much more rich to the generalized audience because they're represented in these episodes.
Absolutely. And again, it's that tapestry that I always harp on about Nocturne Radio and other shows of how can you enrich everything around you? And it's almost the responsibility of a Star Wars creator to consider the whole. And it's so exciting to see Jon Favreau do that in this episode, and in the first one that he's directed hands-on, he's shepherded the entire show, but you really get a lot of his perspective on everything that you're saying. You know, these fan observations, these observations from creative people like you, put through the lens of somebody who has, you know, the money, the means, and everything. And what did he gather from the experiences that he's had with Tatooine that he can now, you know, tie in and marry to the overall legacy of a place like Tatooine that we've had across the fandom.
It's such a spiritual place to us as fans, but we also have to remember too, it's such a spiritual and important place to even just theater goers who only see the films, and that's kind of where the buck stops with Star Wars for them. And it's so cool, as you said, to re-examine this planet through this lens, even for the non-diehard fans. They're getting in this as well, and it's actually really notable. So let's just get into the episode, Alden. So of course, Mando opens up. We have a great Western scene at the beginning of this episode. That's such a great moment because all the graffiti. We, of course, have the creatures. This planet still looks like Lothal to me.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yeah, it sort of has a, you know, the early seasons, like seasons 1 and 2, before it was not entirely Imperial, but also just a little bit, a little bit downtrodden. And it's interesting. Like, I would love to know more about that place. You know, some people speculate, oh, is this the canonized version of, like, you know, Nar Shaddaa or something like that? And
right.
Yeah, I would love to see more of it because even just that, I mean, we literally got one street and one location, and in love with it.
Gamorrean fights, which is something we didn't know we needed, but is great and fills out the lore even more, you know? And then of course we got great action scene and we see Mando's ruthlessness at the end of it, kind of some Batman maneuvers, you know, which you and I are big fans of Batman. So that's that's nothing different to us, but it was interesting to see him this ruthless this early in the season. You won't die by my hands. I promise you that. Let's leave it hanging.
Straight up the Batman Begins. You know, I won't kill you. I don't have to save you.
Oh, yeah. Or, you know, if you want to intimidate a man, a fall of this height won't kill him. I'm counting on it, you know?
Yeah.
That sort of thing. It's just very Batman, which is interesting. And, you know, we got some parallels with Batman and the Mando, some. But then we, of course, find out information that the last information we had about a Mandalorian was, of course, on Tatooine. So Mando goes back to Tatooine, of course, has another great interaction with Peli and the pit droids, prequel fan of me, just them bringing all the elements of Star Wars together is always a good feeling. And I actually think she's stronger in the season than the first season. And that's a great thing as well. And yeah, Mando gets set on this quest to go to Mos Pelgo, like you mentioned. And we, of course, come face to face with Boba Fett's armor, which, of course, was a great fan moment the first episode.
Agreed. And I do want to ask you real quick, just for your viewing experience, when it comes into tying into Boba Fett's armor and, of course, the reveal of who is wearing it in Cobb Vanth, when we got the cut to title, cut to chapter name, and it said The Marshal. Did you have that moment of, oh, they're going to do it?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
As Alden knows, but, and probably listeners know as well, I'm a big fan of the Chuck Wendig Aftermath series. And, you know, the first book is considered most people's least favorite, though people still enjoy it. And, you know, the second and third book, absolutely stellar. But what's interesting, Alden, is the first book has some really incredible moments that are these side stories. And they were truly some of my favorite parts of this series, this Aftermath series that Chuck Wendig did. Man, that Marshall segment in the first book, of course, where he's with the Jawas, which we see in this episode, mm-hmm. and gets the Mandalorian armor. It's more ambiguous in the book what the armor is, because it's described through text, and it's not even that deep in description. So it kind of leaves you wondering. And of course, we see it this time. We see Boba Fett's armor, though it has clearly been stained by the acid and damaged a bit more, which I think is very interesting. Yeah, just bringing the Marshal to live action. You want to talk about a behind the scenes more than B character, as you mentioned earlier. That was the Marshal, who is this character who was in a short side story of a major Star Wars novel, but had no impact on the greater plot. Mm-hmm. That was purely just these side stories to build the universe post Return of the Jedi and the Death Star falling. And then we had it.
Yeah. I mean, it's just this beautiful moment of synergy. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, sometimes people say that they wish that Lucasfilm and Star Wars as a story, as a brand, would be more rewarding. And it's times like this where you realize, like, they're picking their spots and they're trying to make things as effective as possible. And do I believe for a second that Jon Favreau knew who Cobb Vanth was or what Aftermath was? No, I don't. But that's the beauty of the way that they've set things up, because he can say in the writer's room, you know, what I'm thinking is that there's this lawman and maybe he's like a fake Mando and they have a showdown. Then it's up to people like Dave and it's up to people like the story group to say, you know, actually, we kind of have one of those, which is sort of what happened with Rogue One. Where they were like, oh, we need a radical. We need someone who's like the anti-Mon Mothma. Then it was a story group that said, hey, you know, we have one of those. Why don't we move this person over? And we've seen that now a couple different times, and we will see it more in this season. And I think that Cobb is a perfect character to make that exciting crossover moment, to validate the novels in the same way that the third chapter validates animation in a huge way. But it is also a character that is surface level enough, sort of ground, not surface level, ground floor. He's ground floor enough that someone watching it that has no idea that there even are Star Wars books is not going to bat an eye, because they give you everything you need.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And what an actor to play him. Timothy Oliphant coming into this role, and of course, his rich history in Westerns, in playing this type of character, it just feels right for the audience, even if they have no prior information, like you just mentioned, Alden. And, you know, what great questions we're asking ourselves. And of course, once again, one of my favorite parts of this show is all the things we know as diehard fans, Mando doesn't know. Mm-hmm. The appearance of the child being the same species as Yoda. Words like Mandalorians, or even like seeing something like Boba Fett's armor, seeing things like the Tuskens and how they interact. The list goes on and on. Of course, season one was full of Easter eggs as well. But they're not just Easter eggs. They are moments where Mando doesn't, it may be something Mando's experienced in a different way than we have, or he's never experienced it. But we have, and the way they kind of recontextualize things for the audience and kind of subvert your expectations sometimes, or you know exactly what it's going to be and you're waiting for Mando to catch on. These are all interesting story beats we have in the series. And, you know, Boba Fett's armor was used, I think, in this way, because I know you're not the biggest fan of Boba Fett, Alden.
Me?
Yeah. You? And Mike and I have voiced our opinions about him. Of course, we were big fans when we were younger, but, you know, you grow in Star Wars, you grow in your age. And what's so funny to me is listeners of the show will know, and I'm sure Alden knows too, I am just a massive fan of the other bounty hunters that aren't Boba Fett. I've just been obsessed with Bossk since I saw him the first time. I've been obsessed with IG-8, Forlom, even Zuckuss, these side characters. Dengar could, you know, take him or leave him sometimes, though he plays interesting stories and legends with Boba Fett, and he actually fleshes up Boba Fett a lot more. Seeing Boba Fett's armor is still a moment for all of us. And of course, it's a moment for the non-super nerds out there. It's a moment for just the theatrical fans of Star Wars, I think. And that's notable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is sort of the next evolution from getting Maul and Solo. You know, it's that type of stuff where it's been a few years, phase one, sort of, so to speak, of Star Wars. You know, we got our sequel trilogy out of the way, and now it's let's tighten every screw and sort of take advantage of every opportunity.
Absolutely. And we can have things like Easter eggs, but also by building on these smaller stories, like you mentioned, with these background characters. So, of course, with the Marshal, we got to see our first canon representation of the Death Star 2 being blown up outside of the films. And I thought
it looks like it's on ESPN, which I love.
Yeah. And everybody's just drinking and having a time. And of course, the Mining Guild takes over and we have the rest of Marshall's story. But Mando and the Marshal end up working together because Din has this sort of creed going on where he's like, that armor cannot stay in your possession. I have to take it to my people. It cannot stay with you. And so they come to an agreement to, of course, kill the crate dragon, which has been terrorizing their town. Now, you want to talk about something, Alden, that's been in the Star Wars zeitgeist since day one, because we had the crate dragon skeleton in New Hope, and of course, Obi-Wan doing the crate dragon call to scare off the sand people since day one of Star Wars, something we've seen represented in Legends, even in some canon, and of course, in video games a lot. Now we get the crate dragon in a cinematic format brought to everyone.
Yeah, and it's just the Tremors-esque, you know, very desert monster trope of the rumbling and the shaking. And also, just like in the Western town, you know, it's a Star Wars equivalent of bandits. You know, it's a bunch of black hats, you know, a bunch of outlaws, and we can hear the rumbling of the horses. This is the Star Wars equivalent of that, where the whole town's kind of like, oh my, this again. Let's hope we just lose one Bantha, you know. Let's hope it's a good day. The Lord is smiling down on us here in Mos Pelgo. Right. And, man. And you know, the lawman will protect us. And it really conveyed that vibe really well, but also with creating that spark in Star Wars fans that know the crate dragon to say, oh man, we're going to see it fully realized. Like, this is going to be nuts. And they do a great job of doling it out in perfect doses across the episode, where even our characters are like, wait a second, that's just the neck? Like, you know, you have that reaction of like, oh my God, like this is cataclysmic. Like there's a, you know, a potentially, you know, society threatening beast here that Luke never had to deal with, that Anakin never had to deal with, Owen Lars, none of these people. And it's pretty interesting.
Oh, absolutely. And it's been always been a favorite creature of mine. And to see it fully in canon now, like in a visual form, more than just a skeleton, I mean, you couldn't ask for more, right? And like you said, these sort of Western elements coalescing here, it's perfect because, you know, these are things I love so much in the Kenobi Legends book, you know, written by John Jackson Miller. And if you ever listen to the audiobook, it's been narrated by Jonathan Davis. Man, what an incredible book, because it is about these small towns, these farmers and Kenobis trying not to intervene. He's trying not to be a Jedi by also helping people without being a Jedi, you know? And there's these interesting elements. I saw moments of that in this Mando episode. And of course, this brings the Marshal, Mando, and the Tuskens and the farmers, the people of Mos Pelgo, all together. And they have to take down this Leviathan, this beast. And of course, this ensues in great teamwork, but also we see some great moments of Tusken culture, the farmer culture, these things like where Mando mentioned season one, like everyone that lives on Tatooine are actually the invaders. The Tuskens live here and things like that.
Yeah.
Things that we've known in Star Wars as these sort of deeper dive fans, but maybe the generalized audience didn't know that the Tuskens were truly the native people, and the farmers and the people that built the cities were the people inhabiting Tatooine thousands of years later. And we see all this in the episode. We see, of course, the Tuscan sign language. We see the Tuscan dogs. We see the Banthas traveling in single file. We see incredible, incredible Bantha puppets, which I was very happy about. No elephants were wearing super hot clothes in this making of this. And, you know, it's just great moments. And of course, Alden, at the beginning of the episode, you mentioned the aspect ratio change. My jaw dropped. So let's jump to the fight against the crate dragon. We, of course, immediately when the fight starts, the aspect ratio changes to basically full IMAX 235 aspect ratio. And what more can be said? This is a great sequence, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's thrilling. And they do a great job of building the tension. I mean, everything from when they finally get in the planning stage and they're about to execute, and you get that great moment with Cobb Vanth where he's like, you know, what are those little pebbles? And Din's like, oh, that's us. That's the crate dragon. And then they're
like, it's not the scale.
Yeah. He's like, that's not to scale though, right? Just a little bit of sign language. Yeah, that's to scale.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful build. And then, you know, you finally get the three Tusken Raiders, those three brave souls that go and do the call to wake the thing up. And then you get that change. And from that moment on, it's just Western wish fulfillment mixed with, you know, a Star Wars scene that you never thought you'd get. Like, we saw in chapter 3 of the show, directed by Deborah Chow, which is one of my favorites, we saw Mandalorians, you know, rocket off into the sky together to fight men. But this was Mandalorians in the role of not just Western lawmen, but mythical knights. Like, it was two Mandalorians, well, one and a half. Let's give Cobb a 0.5, rocketing off into the sky to slay a dragon. And man, sights like that are just, it just hits that primal place where, like, I'm not sure George Lucas is capable of saying wow, like, in a really awe-inspired way, but that's the kind of stuff where it's like, you know, he'd be proud of, like, what they were able to pull off.
Everything from the visuals, the sound, the characters, like you mentioned, the action. I honestly think, Alden, in this sequence in particular, the action even feels less Star Wars in a positive way. It really feels like people just banding together trying to fight this giant creature, and it feels more grounded and real, especially till the end. I mean, it's just very intense, I think is the word we want to use. And, you know, we've got crazy things like the sound design of Mandalorian. And I'm not sure if Matthew Wood is overseeing all the sound. I know, of course, he's the head of Skywalker Sound, and of course, the cinematic Star Wars movies, a genius guy. But I mean, the sound design of the Krayt Dragon, we have, you know, I nerded out a level. This is a deep cut. You know, when the Krayt Dragon's first coming out of the ground at these brave Tuskens, we have a mix of the Krayt Dragon and the original theatrical cuts from Obi-Wan's voice mixed with the special edition cut of Obi-Wan's voice from the Krayt Dragon call. We have both sounds. We have that high-pitched, you know, whistle into the actual growl yell. And it's just the attention to detail for fans, but also just to bring this to general audiences, like we said, without even nodding to them at all. Just, this is the sound the Krayt Dragon makes. And it's from prior films, but if you don't know that, that's okay. You know, maybe you didn't know much about Tuskens before this film. Maybe all you knew about Tuskens was mainly off of a couple episodes of the trilogies, but now you get this element. It's so excellent, all of it. And yeah, like you said, very heroic. We have Cobb and Mando trying to take charge in this battle. And of course, we're seeing more even of Boba Fett's armor than we've seen in all the cinematic films. So that's pretty interesting. Just conversation to have. And yeah, they try to divert its attention. We have the acid spit. We have so many Banthas that die, which just makes me so sad. So sad.
Rest in peace to some beautiful, beautiful creatures that weren't doing anything except existing, getting their teeth brushed, just being great.
Oh man.
And they went out hard.
Oh, Alden, you should have seen me jump out of my seat when I saw that Tusken using the gaffy stick to floss the Bantha's teeth. I was like, this is next level for fans. This is next level that the gaffy stick. Oh my goodness. I just couldn't handle it. But yeah, every time a Bantha was killed, I was very upset because, you know, the entire life Legends fan of me was really hurting because I'd know in Legends, and I think it's back in canon again, Tuskens form these lifelong relationships with their steed, essentially their one Bantha. And, you know, if they ever lose their partner, the other member, whether it's the Tusken was killed or the Bantha was killed, the other member is pretty lost after that onward. So it's a true loss that we lost some Banthas. Some great Tuskens lost their greatest friend, you know. Yeah, but it's a great fight. And of course, Mando, we know how it ends because Mando does a pretty intense Jonah and the whale type move, and we kind of bring this fight to an end through some pretty dire means, but it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a great, I mean, this whole episode is full of great character moments that show growth for Din, which I think is a trend across the season so far. So, like, you know, at the beginning you see, like, he's warmed up to the pit droids, and now in this one he has come to respect Cobb in this moment, and he's come to sort of realize the importance of not just leadership, but also of trust in a general sense, and he's trying to impart trust on the townsfolk and the sand people for each other. And when he says, like, just take care of the kid, like, he in that moment is entrusting Cobb to carry on his work if this doesn't pan out. And it's really powerful.
It really is. No, you're absolutely right. And what a trend we're going to see going forward in this season is Din's growth as a father, as kind of this new role in his life that, of course, was starting early in last season, but it's been cemented the finale onward, and now he's truly committed to it. And that's something we're going to see more of in this season. But yeah, what a great episode. Of course, Alden, this episode ends with the cameo. And, you know, I don't know. You mentioned Maul earlier, and something Mike and I talked about on the show a long time ago when Solo came out is the Maul moment was interesting. It was, I'm not going to say divisive, but it was an interesting moment because the diehard fans, maybe not even the diehard fans, the major Star Wars fans to the diehard fans knew exactly what that meant, nerded out that it was Ray Park, nerded out that it was Sam Witwer's voice, and then we even got a small moment, and it made perfect sense with the timeline that Maul was controlling all these criminal syndicates.
Right.
But then the casual moviegoer was confused because they might not even know where Solo took place in the timeline to begin with, and then they see Maul, and now they're a little bit out of sorts. What do you think about this moment with Temuera Morrison at the end with the gaffy stick, with the Tusken cycler, with the Tusken cloak, watching Mando drive by on the speeder bike with the Boba Fett armor?
You know, I think it's one of those things that plays on multiple levels in the same way the Krayt Dragon call sort of Easter egg plays. And it's obviously astronomically bigger than that, but it's effective because if this is your first Star Wars experience, and we have to assume that there are some people out there, I'd love to talk to somebody that this is their first Star Wars. Wow. That'd be incredible. Yeah. But for them, it's a, oh, well, that's going to be important. And they don't think about it beyond that level. Or they might say, oh, he's from Aquaman. Or, oh, he's from anything else that he might be in.
Moana.
Moana, exactly. That's Moana's dad. It plays in, on that level of, you know, maybe he's a Mandalorian. Like, they might have very basic and valid questions based on what this episode gave them. Maybe their thought is, he's a bounty hunter. Because they remember from season one that there are people that have fobs on the baby. You know, it might be something like that. But then for everyone else, it's, oh my God, it's Temuera. And that means, oh Jesus, this, that, the other thing. And it all plays. Yeah. And there's even in the middle reactions where, you know, like my girlfriend is a Star Wars fan and she's become more and more and more hardcore. She's finishing up Rebels now and she watches the show. And so she's expanding, you know, at a constant pace. And she had this moment where the episode ended and she looked, she goes, huh. And then it was like a second beat and she goes, oh, she realized what she was looking at. And I think that there's a whole spectrum of reactions there and they all work. You know, it works on level one and it works on level 10.
Yeah, I think the spectrums, you nailed it because I watch the show with a couple diehard fans and a couple fans who are definitely more than just an average moviegoer, but maybe somewhere in that spectrum, like you mentioned. And, you know, their first thought was, wait, is that Django? Wait, I know what that means, you know? And it's sort of this like, you know, it's this stair stepping of, well, that's the guy who played Django because I know episode two well because I'm a little bit more than the average Star Wars moviegoer. But wait a second, Django died. Wait a second, his son is a clone of him. And then we climb all the way to the top where we've got people that maybe read Legends 30 years ago where Boba Fett climbed out of the Sarlacc pit and, you know, missing a leg and his armor's burned to a crisp and, you know, Dengar drags them out barely and, you know, they lose the armor and things like that to this new amalgamation of, you know, Temuera being back. He's looking pretty rough. He's got a scar. Is that from the Sarlacc pit? Is that from something else? Great questions to have. I'm just happy Temuera's back. Can the man grow a full beard? Is it gray? I don't know. I'm just waiting for it because we know what the next step in this means. This is multi-layered, you and I, Alden, because of course, Boba Fett being back in a show titled The Mandalorian is inherently interesting. And the most interesting thing to me is that Boba Fett hates the Jedi. And this show is about the main character being a father to a Force-sensitive child and getting him to the Jedi. And that's just an interesting story beat alone. Forget that it's a Boba Fett, you know. Then you have this Boba Fett, his history with the Jedi arguably murdering his father under his eyes. You've got some interesting story beats there. It doesn't matter how deep of a Star Wars fan you are. And then you go one step further. Is Temuera signed on for the long haul now? Is he ready to play Rex in the future or in the past of the story? Time will tell.
God, I hope so. Or is he ready to play Cody? do we get a showdown?
Great question. Great
question. In another upcoming show. I mean, now we're just nerding out, but that's the beauty of having him back in the fold. You know, that's the beauty of having this character.
Well, it's kind of endless, right? I mean, it's kind of like, will we get something as obscure as an Ahsoka flashback with someone like Fives or something, or Jesse? Like, these are things that, you know, fans everywhere think about now that Tamora's back in the picture, just more than he's back as Boba Fett, but he, of course, is back in the zeitgeist of an actor working with these great creators at Lucasfilm. So time will tell. And, you know, we have great technology too. Like, I know Tamora's older, but we've seen what they've done in the Marvel films, de-aging these actors' faces we know so well. None of that's a concern to me. It's just, how can this be interesting in the future, you know? And Tamora being back is just interesting enough. And that's it, you know? And if we get more Boba content, that's neat. If we get more Rex content, even better in my book. But just him being back in the Star Wars family is what I'm most excited about.
I couldn't agree more. It's a very, very compelling ending. I'm glad that it was executed the way it was. It's sort of that, you know, if you're a hardcore fan, you see the back of his head and you're like, oh, it's got to be him. And then when they do the turn, I didn't think they would go as far as to show the face. I was like, oh my God. And immediately my brain started racing because, you know, you talk about the child and Boba and what they can mean for each other in terms of theme. It's like, what is Boba if not a foundling? But he's been told his entire life that he's not legitimate. Like, you could strike parallels between this adorable little thing and this grizzled old jerk, and it could be so interesting.
Yeah, who hates the Jedi, and that's been established in Legends canon and above. You know, it's such an interesting thing. And, you know, where's Boba today? You know, we saw the changes through Luke all the way to The Last Jedi. Maybe Boba's had some major changes in his life between we last saw him. Who knows? You know, maybe he's had some sort of reckoning after surviving the Sarlacc pit. But the most important part is Tamora's back. And I think what's important now, Alden, moving forward, is I'm assuming most people are going to want him to make an appearance later in the season. But if he doesn't, he will in a future season. So I'm not too worried about it. Whatever serves this story in this season is what I want.
Could not agree more. This was an excellent start.
And that moves us right into episode 2, which, of course, we get some great cantina moments. We get Dr. Mandible and Pelly. I mean, playing Sabacc. What more could we have?
Yeah, it's so charming. This is Pelly's best episode, I think. Just this opening of the, you know, he'll give you the information, but you have to cover his bet.
You talked about on Octo Radio the importance of turning on subtitles with this show. And I think especially so on your second viewing. But if you want to do it on your first viewing, I'm all for it too, because my wife is all about subtitles. I'm not. I am definitely with second viewings. It's just sort of a cinema thing I have where I try to always watch the first viewing without subtitles. But you're right. On this show, if you watch with subtitles and you see texts like Dr. Mandible or Frog Lady, colon, dialogue, it's almost like they're having a fun time with the audience.
Oh, they have to be. I mean, there's like Frog Lady screams, like there's stuff in these subtitles that are so absurd that you have to be cackling as you type it. It's amazing.
It's worth the price of admission. And of course, we have Pelly put Mando on this mission to escort Frog Lady, something we were not expecting, who is a passenger, you know, aptly named, of course, the episode. And then, of course, she has the last of her spawn with her, and she needs to meet her husband on a water world of Trask. And man, this episode is quite a treat, Alden, if you just want to pick up from there, because there's so many things that are going through my mind, but I want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, this is the episode that for me definitely cemented, you know, the observation I conveyed earlier, which is that you can approach this show as a cousin to the movies because of live action and because of, you know, long form. But this is a cousin to Star Wars animation and to the rock and roll sort of having a great time. Just slick, cool, what looks awesome. Like, so this is such a, you know, it is, you know, the Macquarie come to life, you know, with the spiders and everything. But it's also just like the tone is so unapologetically silly, and it owns every bit of it. And Peyton Reed was perfect for that, I think, coming off of, you know, the 2 Ant-Man films. He got it. He really understood the tone. And this episode is just so tender in how it approaches parenting. It continues the theme of communication. I love that between the Tuskens and Frog Lady, it's sort of Star Wars saying, like, you need to put more effort into trying to make connections with people. Like them not speaking English is not good enough, which I think is a great lesson for today.
Oh man, very good.
Yeah, it's just so good for character.
Well, I also think too, like Star Wars always showcases the diversity of the universe, and you know, you're not always going to be on the same maybe meeting level of other aliens you encounter in the universe, but we see Mando through the episode basically ascend to Frog Lady's level. Essentially, early on, he's pretty despondent. He's pretty not into this. I can't understand you. I don't want to be part of this. I'm just kind of doing this to get to the next place. And then by the end, of course, he's protecting her. He's actually partially understanding her. And of course, we have Richard Ayoade returning to get his check, which I'm super excited about for him because, you know, my wife's favorite comedy show of all time is The IT Crowd. And just bringing him back as Zero to translate for her and bring some humanity to Mando and kind of wake him up, say, you know, Frog Lady's a person as well. She's just on your level. You just don't understand each other. And you need to understand each other. And guess what they do moving forward? And they kind of bond over these scary moments too.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it manages to be sort of the most classically horror and like it's a monster plot type thing.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. Even more so than the Kray Dragon, because the Kray Dragon is sort of like this epic beast. Like it doesn't feel necessarily creepy. This one has a creep factor. It has a gross factor. It has a, you know, relentless swarm type sequence, but this never loses its comedy. I mean, you know, we joked about Frog Lady jumping on all fours, things like that. That's been a big talking point. Frog Lady screaming, grabbing her clothes with her prehensile tongue, things like that. Just the way that the child acts. This episode manages to be such a nice tightrope walk of tones. And, you know, you take all of that and you throw in the looming threat / adversarial relationship with the New Republic that helps flush out this era. And it's really exciting. I mean, seeing these New Republic guys and coming off Squadrons is such a treat.
Yeah. And seeing the New Republic in its new role, not becoming the Empire, but replacing the Empire is very interesting. And I think that's examined in this episode in a more nuanced way than we might pick up at first glance, though now we've seen it a couple times. We can definitely pick up on these vibes where it's like the New Republic has become the new seat of the galaxy. And they're kind of examining their roles. Like, how much do they really want to patrol planets, govern the people, set up garrisons on planets? Well, now you're starting to look a lot like the Empire. And that's where it gets really interesting questions we can ask as fans, but also the people of the galaxy can ask of the New Republic, you know, and maybe this is kind of setting up future plots with that. And of course, it's setting up future stories with the Imperial Remnant that is left, because if they're still around in this world, they are some serious Imperials.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's a theme that's sort of been steadily stretched across the post-Jedi material. I mean, I think about even Cara Dune in her debut chapter in season one of chapter four, where she says, yeah, I was a drop soldier, this, that, the other thing, you know, the rebellion, doing jobs, nasty, whatever. And then she says, you know, and then we ended up protecting dignitaries. Then we ended up, you know, suppressing riots. Then we ended up doing all this stuff. And
pretty nuanced, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It shows that theme, you know, of believe, if I remember correctly, in Game of Thrones, the line is, you still think, you know, winning and ruling are the same thing, something to that effect. And yeah. And it's an interesting theme that Star Wars, I think, had to explore in a lot of ways.
It's classic tropes, but it's also classic history. You know, the quote, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. We're seeing the seeds of that with the New Republic. Not that the New Republic is going to be the most corrupt government that's ever been, but it's just sort of when you're in a position of power and influence, there's only a certain level that you can govern on a reasonable level. And we're going to see more of that moving forward. And stuff we saw with the Republic and the prequels. I love that it's being echoed in Star Wars again and again and again, whoever's in power. And we're seeing that with these New Republic, even just X-Wing pilots who patrol these Outer Rim planets. And yeah, Din almost loses to them. I mean, we have a great chase. And then of course we have the spider sequence, which you mentioned, which spoke to me as a big fan of MacQuarie. And of course we've seen these spiders before in old books and legends and things like that. And just bringing them back and having this great moment where I said Mando and Frog Lady bond. And of course, they survive this through the help of these New Republic soldiers. But they also don't really help Mando get out of the situation. They just protect him enough so he survives. And they're like, we're just going to kind of ignore some of the laws you broke in our minds and we're going to move on, you know? And it's kind of interesting.
And I love that it's a direct result of, you know, the events of Chapter 6. The season overall has done a great job of... Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was
including
it was
Zero coming back, you know?
Zero, yes. The way that they've managed to take those middle chapters that people said, oh, they don't matter. Well, Chapter 1 elevates Chapter 5 and well, Chapter... 9 elevates Chapter 5, and now Chapter 10 elevates Chapter 6, and it's this nice cyclical pattern of, oh my goodness, all that mattered, and the criminals, I forgot about the criminals, and oh man, and I never considered that he'd be wanted man for what happened with Matt Lanter, and it's a super interesting way of table setting and reminding you of the consequence.
Yeah, and I do like that they do reference Mando's good deeds in that episode, like that they actually knew the footage. Of course, you know, this goes further, you know, with Dave Filoni being one of the returning pilots, full circle once again, the Wolf Leader, who responded to the beacon as well, but they saw Mando did his very best to do what's right, to not kill anyone, including the criminals that were breaking the law, and they kind of give him a pass. And that's something maybe the Empire wouldn't do. So we do see the beacon of light there, that is the New Republic, even though these guys are kind of being more... they're trying to be these upholders of the law and stuff too. So we got some interesting nuance going on. But of course, as you said, Alden, it's building the world that we have not seen. I mentioned this on Project Starhawk and you and I's campaign episode. I'll continue to mention it. This is one of my favorite periods in all of Star Wars, whether it be Legends, canon, etc. And I'm so excited to see it being fleshed out because I want to see more about the Imperial Remnant. I want to see more about this New Republic founded by Mon Mothma and Leia. I want to see some more of these political turmoils in the galaxy and these conflicts to getting the galaxy kind of back in a position where it's in balance again, because the Empire has created such a black hole for good and bad.
Absolutely. I think you summed it up perfectly there. This is a story about the galaxy healing and the galaxy reacting. And sometimes it comes down to small moments like Greef Karga saying, like, well, if it bothers you, why don't you go submit a report in the Corps? Like, it comes off, you know, tongue in cheek, but also it's these moments where you realize, you know, like you, I think you phrased it great there with the black hole. What does a power vacuum do? And how do men like Gideon, that were not the chosen few, you know, you're not in the neo-Nazi club, you know, you don't get to come back later. So what are you going to do with the time you have left? And they're a wounded animal. And the New Republic knows that they're a wounded animal. And then they have to deal with guys like Din along the way. So from their perspective, I get it. I get their perspective. But at the same time, you're always going to root for your boy.
That's true. Yeah, that's probably one of the best parts of this show, is that we're always going to, no matter what happens, pull for the Mandalorian and the child, the father and the son, because this show is much smaller scale than the rest of Star Wars. And that's what kind of makes it so strong, I want to say, at the end of the day, because we don't necessarily choose sides as hard as we do in the past. And I'm actually more interested to see what happens in the future with Mando, with, of course, the Empire, with more of the Empire, with more of the Mandalorians, with more of the Jedi potentially, and of course more of the New Republic, because his interactions with those factions are very different from what we've seen in the rest of Star Wars, and even more so with the child in his stead.
Absolutely. It's the whole show, man. It's the whole show has this special way. It has a special way of being everything that is familiar. And that's why it's so successful, because some people criticize Star Wars for being too familiar. Some people criticize it for that's not Star Wars enough. This one somehow manages to be both every single time, because it's a story you've never seen. This lone wolf and cub, you know, that's one of the tropes they had not brought in. But what do? They paint the trope with the iconography of Boba Fett and the iconography of Yoda. They wash their hands of both characters by saying, no, this is Din Djarin and the child, completely new. You wanted new. But the visuals is like, ah, you got me. You know, it's things like the Krayt Dragon. Ah, you got me. That's what Jon Favreau's been able to tap into.
Couldn't have said it better. Yeah, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the season. So it's been a really exciting time talking about episodes 1 and 2 of The Mandalorian. We hope it prepped you for our next episode about episode 3. Interestingly enough, this is a shorter episode, Alden, but I think we have almost equally things to say. So thank you for listening to Canon Cantina. Of course, you can follow the show on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at The Canon Cantina. And you can send feedback, Star Wars thoughts, and show inquiries to canoncantina@gmail.com. You, of course, can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Jesse Aiken. That's JSCEAKIN. And check out my weekly podcast all about Marvel Comics and the Marvel tabletop game Crisis Protocol, Fury's Finest. Alden, where can the people find you?
Yeah, everybody can find me on Twitter and Instagram at AD_Strider or A.D.Strider. And then you can find me talking Star Wars on Octo Radio, which we're covering the whole season episode by episode for Mandalorian, as well as our standard episode, which are interview-based. At the time of this recording, I just finished up an episode with Brian Mattias, who actually designed Din Djarin, who is a senior concept designer at Lucasfilm, brought other characters to life, some we've seen, some we will be seeing soon.
Very exciting.
That interview will be up for people to check out. So yeah, Octo Radio, A-H-C-H-T-O Radio.
Yeah, and check out my other podcast, Project Starhawk, where Alden and I were talking not too long ago about the story elements we really enjoyed of Star Wars Squadrons. And recently, Mike and I posted our latest episode about A Beginner's Guide to Fleet Battles, Patch 2.0, and just our thoughts of the game so far up to patch 2.0. So we really hope you check out Project Starhawk. But that's going to be it for the Canon Cantina. Until next episode, where we talk about the third episode.
Boring conversation anyway.